Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts on the channel. And today we're talking to Lorenzo Cervice, who is an assistant professor of literature and medicine at Lehigh University, and the author of the new book, Medicine is War, The Martial Metaphor in Victorian Literature and Culture, which is just out from SUNY Press. Lorenzo, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you very much for having me.
I wondered if you could begin our interview by telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I was born in Mexico City, and my family immigrated to the United States when I was about a year old, and I grew up in Houston, Texas. And once I graduated high school, I sort of gave college a try, but didn't do it so well and fumbled around for a few years until I finally found myself in California, Palm Desert, where I was an emergency medical technician for a little while, and then became a personal trainer. And after a few years of doing that, I ended up working as a fitness instructor for the Betty Ford Center Drug and Alcohol Recovery Hospital. In the midst of that, doing that for 5 years, I started going back to school at a community college and was working toward a degree in exercise physiology because of my profession. I was interested in it. Along the way, I took biology courses and chemistry courses and pretty much the things you needed as prerequisites for medical school, along with English classes all the time because I needed requisites, and sometimes I just needed credits and I liked it and I was good at it. After so many years and I was getting close to the point of graduating, I kind of needed, because of time constraints and my job, sort of finish a track. So I started taking practice GRE and practice MCAT exams, and did better on the GRE than I did on the MCAT. Then decided what I wanted to do, and was thinking about going to graduate school for exercise physiology and kinesiology. Had this dream that I wanted to be an exercise physiologist for NASA. Then I learned, just kind of around the area, that there was the University of California, Riverside. I was looking at just what graduate programs in English look like. And I discovered that, there was a person there, Dr. Susan Zeger, and she had written a book on the history of addiction, or the history of the idea of addiction in 19th century American and British literature and culture. So obviously, since I worked in the, addiction medicine field, I was kind of interested and drawn in that. So I read her book, and I had no idea that you could talk and learn and study medicine outside of medicine, as it were, and certainly not from a literary, cultural, historical perspective, I came to learn. And my wife, who's a pharmacist, who pretty much taught me everything I know about medicines, she always, you know, always would tell me, like, you know, you're going to go to medical school, or you're going to go to pharmacy school, like, you're really interested in pharmacology, And I'm like, yeah, but I suck at chemistry. And she's like, well, you just want to study medical things. And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, well, it's unfortunate there's no such thing as a degree in medical things. But it turns out I was kind of sort of able to do that. I applied to all the local graduate schools that were within a certain radius of where I lived in Palm Desert, because we had just bought in a house after I'd been working for so many years. And the only one I got into was the University of California, Riverside. And so I started going there, and it was a wonderful program. And after a year or two as a master's student, I was interested in so many things between new media, comic books, video games, theory. I started to become very interested in narrative, what was called then and still called narrative medicine, and this idea of medical humanities. And since I was kind of drawn there by Professor Zeger's work on addiction, I became really interested in the history of medicine. And I actually didn't have any, I had more of an affinity toward postmodern literature, actually. And I didn't really like or know much of Victorian literature, but at a certain point I had to pick a field. And that sort of got defined by, well, what period of time and place has the most interesting medical history that I could write about? And that's how I came to Victorian studies. Throughout my degree, I started writing about, I wrote a paper on Dracula and about how Dracula was sort of figured as this kind of at once a state enemy and at once medical infection. And it drew on this old paper in Bioethics for Medical Humanities Journal, I think, by an author named Paul Hodgkin, called Medicine is War and Other Analogies. And it talked about different analogies about medicine and in terms of war or journeys and the other typical metaphorical frames that are thought of. That's kind of where I got to at least this topic. But I finished grad school in 2017. And as I was finishing, I was really fortunate to have a job come up at Lehigh University that was looking for somebody with a dual, they wanted somebody with a dual appointment in both English and their health medicine and society program, which is a health humanities program plus and mostly with a lot of social science. So medical sociology, medical anthropology, bioethics. And so they wanted somebody who could do literature and medicine, not necessarily a Victorianist. But since throughout my graduate career, I was fortunate to work with people like Professor Cheryl Vince, as a graduate student, she co-edited a book with me on zombies and medicine. And I had sort of been able to publish on medicine in contemporary popular discourse in a few different venues. Like I wrote a paper on psychopharmacology in Clockwork Orange. Then I had a paper on sort of the theory of contagion in Matthew Arnold's in an edited collection I did. And I feel like I was just so fortunate to be able to have a sort of repertoire and archive of saying like, hey, I can do like broadly most kinds of literature, although I can focus on Victorian, but I can also just talk about medicine generally from a critical, theoretical, historical, and literary perspective. So I think it was a really good fit. And I was so extraordinarily fortunate to get that job, and it's been wonderful. And I've been here for, I think this is my fourth year, and I'm, my tenure is currently under review, and I think it's in like the last of the, I don't know, it's like seven echelons it goes through or whatever. Uh-huh. So I think it's in the final two. So we're still waiting to hear, but I'm hoping to hear good news.
That's exciting. And I did not know that about, I just taught Zeger's book.
Oh, you did?
Yes. That was the book I mentioned about, before we started recording.
Oh my gosh. That is so funny.
The coincidence. Anyway, let's get into medicine as war. Did it grow out of that essay that you read in graduate school, or how did you come to write this book?
Yeah, so I wrote this paper on Dracula. I wrote this Dracula paper on Dracula for Susan Zeger's class on Victorian media. And one of the sources I found was a source in this Paul Hodgkin article that talked about, like, it's just kind of short perspective review piece about different metaphors in medicine. And then I started looking into Wyckoff and Johnson's work on metaphors we live by and sort of different ideas and kind of very clearly saw that this was like a dominant operative metaphor. And I saw that people had written about it in bioethics and philosophy and linguistics, and some people in clinical ethics. And then there was Susan Sontag, Illness as Metaphor, that talks about the war metaphor emerging from the age of germ theory. And then pretty much any other time I saw it mentioned explicitly, it was usually in reference to that, or kind of talked about in passing, or used itself as a heuristic to kind of describe the historical, I won't say progression because I don't like that term historically, but the process in which medicine developed as a field in the face of infectious disease from the 17th to the 21st century. And so I became interested in this idea, and I wrote this paper about Dracula, and Professor Zeger, Susan, she liked it and she thought it was interesting. And she just started asking me really interesting questions about it. And at the same time, I had read this book. I can't remember. It's by Semenza. I don't know if you've read it, but it's about like how to do graduate school in the 21st century.
Have not read it.
And
it's probably too late now. Anyway, yeah. go on.
And so one of the suggestions that he had is if you can kind of hone in on a dissertation topic early on and make your seminar papers around it, like that can be useful. And so I kind of sort of try to do that strategy. And so after the Dracula paper, Susan suggested I try to apply for fellowships and grants to go to archives, and I ended up going to the Wellcome, which is the favorite place in the world. And this was after I'd written a paper on Joseph Conrad and Heart of Darkness and its relationship to tropical medicine, not in a sort of medicine as war inflection, but just kind of on the same topic. So then I started doing some archival research on Joseph Conrad and the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. And this is where I started to see some very real material connections between military medicine and civilian medicine, public health, and then medicine as war metaphorically in literature as this kind of bridge between those things. And then, so when I came back and I talked to Susan about it, and she asked me, well, yeah, what's the relationship between actual war and medicine is war? And so she's like, what about blood transfusions and amputations and field hospitals and, hygiene in military medicine, the Crimean War. And so that kind of led me down this whole trajectory, of that. And, you know, the dissertations, as they do, they get very, very, very big. And so I ended up writing my PhD exam paper, which is one thing we had to do for exams, was on Charles Kingsley's novel 2 years ago, which is about, but it doesn't actually contain much of the Crimean War, but it's all about a local cholera epidemic. And he is just this very heavy-handed 19th century historian and religious and cultural figure. And he was very big into the hygiene movements, you know, all the Florence Nightingale and Edwin Chadwick. And that's kind of how I got on a track. And then where I started to struggle with was, like, how much is this book literary literary studies, cultural studies, and histories, because the more I read about this, the more I started to get into medical history, and the more nuanced I realized medical history, you know, aside from the history of science being distinct fields that have their own, you know, expansive scholarship and depth of research. But then that's aside from Victorian studies. And then that's aside from like trying to learn, you know, and stay attuned to the, you know, the current knowledge of epidemiology and infectious disease, especially when I started to write about more contemporary medicine. So that's kind of the product that this book is out of, this, the challenge, the affordances and challenges of working between disciplines, and trying to negotiate that and do due diligence to the medical historical scholarship, the British history scholarship, the history of science scholarship, the science and technology studies scholarship, the critical theory, and then, of course, the literature and all the people that have written about the literature. And then ultimately at the end, apply it to more contemporary, or speak to its relevance to contemporary issues related to public health, infectious disease, pharmacology, most notably, antimicrobial resistance. And so it's been a ride, and it's always been hard. I always felt like I was never, getting the medicine right enough or getting the history right enough. And then when I was, I would get feedback that like about where what's the literature have to do with it. So then the challenge became to think about like, so is literature just a representation of this historical phenomenon, or does it actually do something? And that's, you know, where I had my other committee members, Professor Cheryl Vent, who does science and technology studies, science fiction and biopolitics. And then, Dr. Joe Childers, who did does Victorian studies, and they, along with Dr. Zeger, along with getting rejections and articles, and then getting some accepted in peer reviews and conferences, and just meeting lots of wonderful people who were mentors and people that thought with me, both senior scholars at other schools and, you know, other graduate students, I was able to kind of put this thing together, finally, after a couple of years, and, get it into, submit it. And while I was in my, I submitted it right as I started my job at Lehigh, mm-hmm. and then, I got some favorable readers' reports, some of it with some tough feedback, but that was good. And so the process worked for me, I think. It made the book better. And then it got accepted with the revisions, and then copy edits came along, and then coronavirus came along, and added a kind of other dimension.
Well, before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about the structure, because you do manage to pull all of these things together. And there is a lot going on in this book, but it's organized in a way that makes it comprehensible. So
thank you. That's so nice to hear.
You classify medicine as war as a genealogy. You say it's a genealogy of the martial metaphor. Can you tell us what that means, and then how the book is organized? There are two parts for our listeners. There are two parts to the book, and it's organized chronologically, roughly.
It is organized chronologically. And this was kind of a difficult choice, because in some ways I've noticed, particularly in the field of Victorian studies and any kind of literary studies that does historical work, it's become more favorable to organize topically and less chronologically, to sort of, push back against chronological organizational logics of canons and such. Mm-hmm. So I kind of struggled how to think about this, but this is where I found some work from beyond medical historians. I often look to the work of Michel Foucault and Nicholas Rose, and that's where I kind of started to think about this as a genealogy, and it was as a kind of not presentist history, but a history of the present insofar as it kind of thought through how all the thinking and idea and material manifestations of medicine as war in terms of contemporary practices and institutions sort of emerged out of these sets of relations and struggles and conflicts and alliances and institutions and people and things like, you know, drugs and other non-human actors like microbes and pathogens, and how all these sort of conflicting actors sort of created these sets of conditions that catalyzed this metaphor to kind of emerge and become a sort of dominant framework through which humans understood the relationship. I focus mostly on infectious pathogens, but I would suggest also broadly with infectious disease and other kinds of disease as well. So that's kind of why I think of it as a genealogy, that not it was a progression or a trajectory toward. It's one slice of a big story, of a big history story, and that emerged out of a specific set of conditions. And the archive I chose out of the kind of mass sample I looked at told this story. And so I shaped it in terms of sort of two parts. I was the one thing I noticed most in the 19th century was this, and in early on when thinking about people who had written about medicine as war as a metaphor, like Sontag, was the latching on to germ theory, which sort of formalizes in the 1880s with Koch's postulates and the discovery of the anthrax pathogen and tuberculosis pathogen, and then right before that, the work of Pasteur. Although, as I think Nancy Tomes accurately describes that, it doesn't really latch on completely in the public consciousness until maybe the early 20th century. And then so before this, you have contagion theory and anti-contagionism or miasma theory. And again, I should qualify that there's a lot of really great scholarships, a lot of this stemming from Edwin Akernick's work on the ideology behind these different disease theories, but more recent great work by historians like Michael Brown and Christopher Hamlin and Christopher Lawrence that also are able to kind of talk about the nuances, and they're not really such discrete entities, but for the sake of the book and certainly for the sake of describing it, I'll kind of delimit them as such. But there was this tendency of thinking of disease as either being caused by noxious smells or bad air, and that's what was referred to as miasma. And then there was another school of thought that thought it was caused by contact between people, although the sort of ultimate cause between people, whether that be a kind of vital force or a poison or some kind of, ethereal thing, wasn't really quite articulated. But there are political stakes in this kind of argument in terms of like what kind of measures you could take to protect or defend or mitigate it. So if something was contagious, then the obvious measures were quarantine and isolation. And the really great work on this is done by Graham Mooney, who's a medical historian at Johns Hopkins, who writes a book about, so aptly titled, Intrusive Interventions. And then the miasmists or anti-contagionists, what they basically suggested was more progressive insofar as like we need to look toward the environment and the things that are causing these noxious smells. That's basically a product of urbanization and the Industrial Revolution, whether that be like pollution and or human waste, as in like feces or as in dead or decaying matter. And so by the mid-century, you have cholera that's sort of this main point of contention. And in the midst of it, you also have things like tuberculosis, which was really hard to, I think, prove causally that it was that it was contact-based or contagious, because that's such a long incubation period. But, you know, cholera causes people to have diarrhea, and, you know, they basically just excrete all their body fluids until they get hyponatremia, dehydrate, and die. And, you know, there is literal filth everywhere. And obviously there's a smell accompanying that from that, and then also from death. And so the smoke for the fire became a very sort of, I think, reasonable understanding to think that way. When I try to teach this history to my students, I try to tell them to not think about history as we used to think and now we know, or like, how could they possibly not know about, you know, the bacteria, but sort of like, what are the sort of epistemic frames or knowledge base and political and cultural values that made this particular way of thinking thinkable versus this one. And I should also add a more recent book that really touches on the miasma aspects about this in the United States is Melanie Kischel's works, The Smell Detectives, An Olfactory History of 19th Century Urban America. And although my work is British, that book is, mm-hmm. is fabulous. And so if readers want to learn more about miasma, they should probably look there. And so basically these kind of disease theories, as I saw in the first part of the century before the Broad Street outbreak, were kind of entangled. And I saw in Mary Shelley, there was in Mary Shelley's Last Man from the 1830s, from 1826, was writing. And before this was the first cholera epidemic, that a pandemic that hit the world, and Britain was sort of, it didn't hit almost, but not quite. Although there's a lot of sort of historical epidemiological evidence that their troop movement in India certainly was a major factor. And then right afterwards, the second cholera pandemic hit, and England did get hit. So that's kind of one of the places where I look to Mary Shelley. And Mary Shelley has this, it's very miasmic, but at the same time, you get sort of contagion logics in it. So most of these books, a lot of these books sort of don't do the kind of discretory categorization of this disease is contagion. This is miasma and this is germ. I mean, for instance, if you go all the way to Dracula, although Dracula is clearly informed by germ theory and he gets described as such in microbial terms and even parasitological terms as another kind of microbial life. I mean, the figuration is still pre-germ theory contagion in terms of like toxin and contact, and then also very miasmic. So there's this weird kind of conflation almost all the time. But when I started to see the division where germ theory started to show up is where I divided it into part two. Mm-hmm. And part one is very much contagion and miasma sort of competing up until through the Crimean War, which is the end of the military component of that proportion, and the earlier part being like the sort of colonial work of the British, and also the sort of fallout from Napoleonic Wars, and the development likewise of the medical profession as a result of military medicine. And again, Michael Brown is someone who I really look to understand the history of the profession relative to that. Because then military historicism is a whole nother animal to deal with. And then part two is when I started to see works that engaged with germ theory very explicitly, like Conan Doyle and Dracula and Heart of Darkness. And then by the time we get to Tropical Darkness, Heart of Darkness and Dracula, germ theory isn't just bacteriology, but there's another sort of field emerging at the time that is parasitology, and it's a function of tropical medicine, which is a very explicit military function and institution. And I would say technology of colonization. And that's kind of sort of the trajectory of the parts, if that was a helpful sort of summation.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. So for any of our listeners who are not literary theorists or graduate trained in English, how did you choose the books that to analyze, or the novels that you were going to analyze in your work?
That's a great question. Yeah, please.
You didn't just pick them at random off the shelf, right?
No. I mean, why do I have this data set amongst all the others? And of course, they're not just books. I mean, most of them are, there is one or two books at work in each chapter, but that's in conversation with a larger archive of medical prose of the period. And the reason I chose these books was either because of their significance in terms of like temporal significance and the moment and period in which they were speaking, like Mary Shelley's, just temporally, it's like just at the right time and it happened to topically fit. And although at the time it wasn't really well regarded, over time, and especially, gosh, in the past 10 or 15 years, it's become like, I mean, some people would disagree, but I would say it's like the new Frankenstein. And it's just also extraordinarily nuanced. Charles Kingsley's book, which a lot of people don't know, and they shouldn't know because it's not a very good book. It's not a fun read. It's really heavy-handed. But the sort of cultural work it's very explicitly doing in terms of nationalism and sort of inculcating this hygienic logic in readers, like very explicitly, and tying it to Christianity and national unity while still, you know, having, you know, appropriate for them, like late divisions of labor. And also at the time it was a very, very widely read novel, and it was reviewed a lot, and that's how I came to choose that one. Dracula, you know, is such an iconic and canonical text. It has so much in it. It's been written about so much. And in fact, I was advised as a graduate student not to try to publish a paper on Dracula, because that's like what everybody does. And it might still be good advice. And I did not, in fact, try to publish the paper on Dracula. But Dracula obviously is even though there's definitely vampiric folklore and mythology that it deploys and refashions, I mean, it's such a sort of cultural touchstone. And temporally also works at such a significant moment in time in 1897. I mean, that's when they discover, or Ronald Ross discovers the life cycle of the malarial parasite. This is sort of the turn of the century. I mean, we get really the rise of eugenics, and we're about to shift into the 20th century. And then there's also the kind of very not so subtle racism and xenophobia and the way it thinks about the past and the present. It pretty much had all the content that I wanted to look at and I thought was important after surveying the other kind of possible options in terms of books that dealt with medicine, either very, very explicitly or more subtly. Conan Doyle became another one, and his is interesting because I talk about a number of his works, but most of his works do not have medicine as war explicitly in them at all, like written as such. And the fact there's only two of them that I recall off the top of my head that do, and those are in the 20th century. So what I started to look at there was the relationship between the ideas that and ideologies that relate and sort of structure medicine as war. And so that would be like militarism and nationalism and xenophobia, control and discipline, and sort of mapping, tracking, sort of surveillance. And so I started to see how those ideas were working. And then I wrote that. And then I wrote the part about where he talked about germs as weapons and used as germs in plot lines in the 20th century and tried to find the connections. And what I did end up finding was that in his prose works, when he was writing against anti-vaccinationists at the period, he's very, very militaristic in his language. And then he writes two books on justifying the Boer War. And so there's a lot of very literal Miller to, and in fact, he volunteered, even though he was too old, to be on the medical front lines in the Boer War. And then when I started to see just the relationship between how he wrote about that and his fiction, and then ultimately his status, like celebrity status at the period, it seemed like a really significant point of inflection. Sample, let's say, if we're using statistical terms, to talk about what's going on in all these moments and all these different discourses that sort of puts the culture on track to metaphorizing medicine as war. Joseph Conrad and Tropical Heart of Darkness is really interesting because there are very few medicine is war or we're fighting disease. It's much more subtle, although there is plenty of illness in the novel and it is tropical illness. It's also sort of like, racialized, the jungle is going to sort of degenerate humanity, civilized humanity. So I started to look there at the relationship more in a historical capacity between British tropical medicine and what was going on in the Congo. And there's plenty of work on this that I drew from there, like Deborah Neal's Networks of Tropical Medicine. And then Emily Taylor Brown, is probably done the most extensive work on Ronald Ross. It was someone whose work I drew a lot from. And so once I understood the context of tropical medicine and the relationship between Britain and the Congo, I had a Heart of Darkness, which had plenty of tropical illness in it. And it was also such a significant work. And it does have theories and representations of microbial life. There's this really interesting scene in there where he talks about sort of the great colonizing, civilizing forces as germs of empire. And of course, Conrad's like, while he is, dehumanizing the native people of the Congo, and we can't deny his sort of racist tropes and language, he's also at the same time writing along with people like writing the Casement Report that are sort of condemning Belgium's actions in the Congo and sort of putting it on the world stage. And at the same time, he's writing through modernism, a very different kind of novel than 2 years ago or The Last Man, or, I don't write about Jane Eyre or Middlemarch, but like anything like that. So I looked at the way that his use of indeterminacy and sort of refraction of ideas that isn't so clear cut is sort of deconstructing the idea of metaphorizing medicine as war, and specifically looking at how tropical medicine as this ostensible humanitarian institution was actually causing harm and, you know, a supportive kind of military infrastructure and colonization. So that's how we go from Shelley to Conrad, which, again, I was really worried about because it seems like a very... very fitting book ending of romanticism to modernism. So I was kind of worried about that because it felt like it fit too well. So I try to write about, you know, that transparently and about why I thought it was useful to order them in this way and why to end it with that. And the other final reason that I end with Conrad is the sort of relationship with Conrad tropical medicine and the beginning of the development of antimicrobial chemotherapy. And by chemotherapy, I don't mean anti-cancer drugs. I mean any kind of synthetic compounds that are able to neutralize microbes, like rather than mercury. Around this time, we start to see the development of organoarsenicals, like Salvarsan in 1912, I believe. And that sort of develops out of drugs that were tested in the Congo that the British had a hand in. And then I started to think about Heart of Darkness and its relationships to bullets and magic bullets. And that's how it sort of takes us into the 20th century, where we get in the 30s sulfa drugs, which after organoarsenicals, which could cure, I'm forgetting the name of the pathogen that causes sleeping sickness, trypanosomiasis. We get sulfa drugs, which are the first kind of pre-antibiotic, the first miracle drugs, as one historian puts it. And then a decade or so later, you get the mass production of antibiotics. And I sort of started to finally see the conclusions that I would suggest that thinking of medicine as war is something that catalyzed antibiotic thinking as a way of mediating the relationship, one of the ways of mediating the relationship between humans and microbes. I hope that answers your question. Yeah, I was trying to answer it in terms of like sample sizes and data sets and methodologies in ways that I guess we might not think about literary studies as much of.
I'm going to ask you kind of to simplify your argument a little bit. Maybe sure. Give us a caricature of it. Tell us how does the Marshall metaphor change over in the course of your book? Maybe you could talk pre or post germ theory.
That would be great. I can do that. Yeah. I think I would start by saying that thinking about medicine as war is not natural. It seems to be our go-to phrase. I mean, if I ask you to describe the immune system with verbs, you will likely, most of us say attacks and, you know, invades, that kind of language. And it would seem that language is a function of the discovery of germ theory. But I suggest otherwise. I see it happening much earlier than germ theory, although it does certainly take off in a different direction after germ theory and after antibiotics. And so another question then becomes like, well, what came before it? And while I'm not an early modernist or medieval or a classicist scholar of medicine of antiquity, the research I did do on pre-19th century medicine, and that I saw is that before the early 19th century, you know, the kind of operative logic or way of thinking about medicine was more in terms of balance. And the really simplistic way to put it would be in terms of the four humors and the human body as being coextensive with the environment. And when there was something out of balance, that could be rebalanced. And that's just kind of a different grammar I guess I would say, of thinking about the relationship between humans and disease processes and disease. And this is also because diseases weren't thought of exactly as things in and of themselves. Again, whether we're talking about pathogens or processes. So we went from balance to antagonism to, I would suggest, antibiosis. And that's not the way it had to be. It is the way that we went. And so what my book suggests is that the language of talking about medicine militarily, like, starts in military medicine, like, textbooks and articles. And then I see it emerge in literature and sort of contemporary periodicals and sort of any most texts that are kind of representative of discourse of that period in Britain from the 19th century. And then I find literature as sort of these, a kind of archive that's able to, that puts these two things together and helps me understand how one related to another. And in some cases, how they explicitly made the connection and, you know, allow that metaphor to travel from the military to the civilian sphere. Is that more helpful?
Yeah, that's great. That's a wonderful summary. And the book takes us all the way up to the present. And so I wondered if you could tell us a little bit, if we were to look around today, where do we see the Marshall metaphor and how does it relate to its sort of previous iterations?
Okay, so before talking about COVID, because that's it's a whole animal, right? I just would you can Google around and just write battle against, the war against, a new weapon for, and you can put that in Google, or you can put that in most periodical search databases, or you can put that in Web of Science and PubMed, and mostly infectious disease will pop up. And again, it's a good exercise to do this pre-2019. Mm-hmm. But I'm just kind of like pulling some up, and like some of the obvious ones are like a battle against antibiotic resistance, which can rhetorically make sense. We're used to this shorthand, but from what I think, I'm a little concerned with that, because I think thinking of this as war, and also that the material historical connections between antibiotics is, and the military industrial complex is one of the things I think that got us here. But just sort of looking around, I also saw an interesting piece that was how to win the war against obesity. And this is another interesting one I saw today that I wasn't expecting to find. Ketamine might be our new secret weapon against depression, which is particularly interesting since, although I'm not very familiar with ketamine's history, but I know that there is a association and also now a trend of looking to drugs that were sort of controlled by the intelligence community and the military in terms of research, like psychedelics. And ketamine was an anesthetic before it was used as an antidepressant. But just the language there of might become our secret weapon against depression, does a lot of interesting things to me. A lot of things kind of flash that, again, I have sort of my preconceived framework for that I don't have evidence for specifically with that. But I think that would be something interesting to pursue. I also think it's interesting to think about chronic diseases like diabetes, or, you know, it could be depression, and think about whether fighting or having wars with them is a useful framework. Cancer is something that plenty of people write about and have written about in terms of war and metaphors, and, you know, often finds plenty of people in their own illness narratives or narratives of loved ones with cancer that are not happy with it, because at least I think in terms of palliative care, it doesn't make sense. Because loss is the ultimate only outcome. But again, here I really want to be clear that I do not want to prescribe people's metaphors for their own illness experience. I think everyone is entitled to metaphorize and figure and narrativize their own illness as much as they want to, and however is helpful for them. And in fact, there is like research that looks at the connections between, for instance, I cite one study about children playing video games about, their cancer being an alien spaceship, and they sort of shoot it, and that having a kind of positive association. And I think it was statistically significant. I can't recall though. So I don't want to be prescriptive to individuals. However, especially in light of 2020, I think we should know that this is a thing. And I was glad to see that when coronavirus came out, and I wasn't surprised to see that it immediately, even in like The Lancet, days after it became left China, there was like an article in The Lancet, I want to say, that was about, it was using Sun Tzu's The Art of War and as a framework to think about coronavirus. And then you have all sort of the political rhetoric. And so what I'm getting at is, I think it's important to understand that this metaphor has a history and a kind of problematic one. Also that it's the go-to and sort of naturalized way of us talking about it. It's not the only one. We can think about disease and illness as process, as journey. A lot of work has sort of now, especially in light of, metagenomics of the microbiome, has started to look at dysbiosis or imbalance of microbial life inside the body, not as like the cause of all diseases, but as one possible cause of diseases, of a number of different diseases. And so then again, especially related to antibiotics, I don't think war is a really good framework for that. I mean, especially when you hear things like scorched earth antibiotic therapy, scorched earth broad spectrum antibiotics causing emergency diff infections. So what I'm getting at, and I think where this relates to like medical practitioners and public health, is that while I would love all medical students to read my book that's too long, I think the takeaway is that there can and should be an attunement to the language that practitioners use when they used to to talk about language, medicine and treatments, and also to be attuned of the language that patients use. And again, not to be prescriptive, but just to be aware. And I realize the limitations of medical practice in the 21st century and now in the face of telemedicine. But there is, Rita Sharon and all the people that have done work in narrative medicine and the way people talk about their illness, there is a lot of clinically relevant information there. And so I would also suggest there is a lot on provider side to think about if there's a reflective moment to think about how they explain really complex physiological or pharmacological or immunological processes in simple terms. I mean, because the fact of the matter is, we can't help but use metaphors for everything. So I think this is one that has a lot of capacity to do harm if not thought about responsibly. Not in every case, but I think in certain cases with practitioners, where I have a lot of concern is with policymakers and politicians and people that have large platforms. Use like the China virus, literally redeploying the kind of magic bullets idea that from the early 20th century and Paul Ehrlich's cure for syphilis of Zalversan, which actually was sort of theorized by Thomas Huxley back in 1881 as a pharmacological torpedo. I think there is a line where there is a responsibility to really consider the language that's being deployed. And likewise with people that have very big platforms online, really think about what metaphors you're using. I see a lot of people trying to be nuanced about how they describe coronavirus in terms of its aerosol transmission. A lot of times this leads to fights between virologists and aerobiologists and environmental engineers, like whether smoke is a good metaphor or whether it's inaccurate because you can still like smell smoke through an N95 mask. So, I mean, just as in statistics, like with language, it's always imperfect, right? I think the question is just to realize the degree of imperfection or the degree of problematic, and then based on that, try to make decisions that are useful materially in the world.
Well, Lorenzo, we've taken up a lot of your time, but I want to ask one more question before our kind of traditional final question. Do you have a favorite alternative to the Marshall metaphor? What do you think? Can you tell us? What are some metaphors that you think are maybe more generative or useful or anyway?
This is the million-dollar question that I always get asked and never have a great answer to. The one thing I have been thinking about, and the one thing one thought I do have, is that when we do say something like the fight against coronavirus, is to perhaps use a simile instead of metaphor. Our efforts to mitigate or to live with or to mitigate or eliminate coronavirus is like a war. And so that sort of draws attention to the fact that you're using a metaphor. And I think that can do some work there. Although that also has its trade-offs. I am increasingly starting to think about health, not health and even in less dichotomous or discrete or ordinal terms and more continuous is a spectrum. So I guess that would really just be like where you currently lie on the spectrum. And, you know, you could use statistical metaphors for that. It's really hard to write about this and not use the war metaphor. So I often turn to things like live with or mitigate. I actually don't think about those as metaphors as much. I think those are very literal. Albeit it's very hard to speak affirmatively about pathogens at the moment. I think for very reasonable reasons. I guess my alternatives are just to think first, just to think if one can think of an alternative like balance or process. Someone in the Atlantic, I believe recently wrote a fabulous article about the immune system as an orchestra. And in terms of its complexity, I mean, I think that's much better. That was much more nuanced and had much more explanatory power than like different, you know, soldiers and lieutenants and whatever. So I think there's a lot out there. And I wish I had done that work, but I haven't as much. But I think my one recommendation and go-to is thinking about the metaphors and language we use generally, whether they be Marshall or not. And think about what they afford, what they allow, and think about what they might delimit. So the recognition of our use of metaphor is kind of the big takeaway. And for this one, if we're talking about war and it is stuck in our lexicon, it could have some uses at scale, at the population scale. And if they do, then I would... my recommendation would be to draw attention to its figuration and use it as an analogy or as a simile. Do you have any ideas? What do you think?
No, I have no idea. That's why I asked.
I mean, how about I know you write about recovery and addiction. I mean, that's an interesting one, right?
I mean, I used the Marshall metaphor. Lorenzo, I used it.
I know. Anyway, and working at an addiction center, I did well too. And like, you know, we're going to beat this heroin addiction. And then there's the other one that I remember patients and providers saying all the time, like there's this gorilla doing pushups in the parking lots.
Or in the corner. Yeah.
Or in the corner. So, and whenever you let your guard down, it will, you know, get you.
Yep.
And I don't know enough about recovery medicine, addiction medicine nowadays, but I imagine there are alternative paradigms. not that one's better or worse, but just that are different and maybe I thought are worth thinking about.
There are emerging ones, and I'm in the process of exploring those now.
Oh, really?
What are you working on now? What is next?
What is next? So next is the science and fiction of antibiosis. And is meant to be that, not that so that it's fictional at all, but the more and more I learn about antibiotic resistance and the mechanism of horizontal gene transfer, the way that a bacteria can share resistance genes across space and time within one generation. And then the fact that there are also resistance genes that existed before we had antibiotics as such. And then the sort of kind of science fictional future that's been projected in a very few pieces of fiction fascinates me and I think is a real actionable problem. And this is actually why I went back to graduate school to get a degree in public health. Because, you know, even though I look toward a lot of microbiology, I mean, in terms of clinical relevance, I'm more and more looking at epidemiology and infectious disease. And I wanted to make sure I was actually knowing, things beside you need to have a p-value less than or equal to 5. And it's what I'm citing. But the book is basically looking at how we got to the idea of antibiosis. So I explore the terms in the 19th century from botany to bacteriology. And then I start to look at its use in sort of the first kinds of fiction that popularized medicine in the 20th century, like Aerosmith by Sinclair Lewis. Mm-hmm. And then things like pop histories of medicine, like The Miracle Drugs by Paul de Kruijf, and the work they're doing. And then the book ultimately concludes with the current science fictional representations of antibiotic dystopian futures, whether that be a video game, an iPhone game, that the Wellcome Trust funded, and I have an article in Osiris about that, a graphic novel that was also funded by the Wellcome Trust about England in 2036 during an antibiotic dystopian crisis and state. And then they also have a collection of short stories. So I'm looking at those, and then also an audiobook in the form that's pretending to be a radio broadcast. So the book is ultimately going to be thinking about the relationship between science fiction, antibiosis, and media form, because these are all different media forms. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, and the kind of last final piece of this that's really kind of, again, thrown a wrench and made this even more fascinating, complicated is, since I've been collaborating with a chemical engineer who works on antivirulence drugs as an alternative to antibiotic resistance, we were kind of framing our collaborative work as past, present, and future. The present person being our science communication scholar, Sharon Friedman. I was able to publish an article in the journal Antibiotics for a special issue on antivirulence drugs that just came out. And that article ended up being about how microbiologists and pharmacologists use Jekyll and Hyde to talk about variable virulence, or the way that virulence isn't an inherent property to pathogens, but it's something that is contextual and relational. And it's not a piece about how science is using literature wrong. It's actually about a piece about how this little shorthand of Jekyll and Hyde is actually so much more emblematic of the argument and the research that they're showing. And to do that, the journal liked that piece to feature it on the cover of the issue, and they asked me to get an illustration. And I suspect maybe they were hoping I would get out of copyright, Jekyll and Hyde picture. But since I was trying to show how Jekyll and Hyde isn't dichotomous, it's more continuous and fluid and entangled, as virulence seems to be as a concept, per the people who study it. I got a medical illustrator under duress in rapid terms to be able to create an illustration that will be the next cover of this journal, Antibiotics, and it will show Jekyll and Hyde in a non-dichotomous, continuous, emblematic, messy form relative to antibiotics. This is by Mesa Schumacher at Mesa Studios. She's a phenomenal medical illustrator, and she created this this piece through a genre she calls disruptive realism, which I believe comes out of the work of Francis Bacon. So now I'm thinking more and more about integrating art into how I'm researching and not just doing it after the fact. And likewise, I'm also looking to a poet named Adam Dickinson in Canada who writes about polymers and microbiomes and endocrine disruptors. And so I'm thinking about how not to just collaborate with scientists, pharmacologists, IDs, epi, public health practitioners, but also poets and artists. So the project, the next thing is getting really big and out of control and messy, but fun.
Sounds fun. Sounds really cool. Lorenzo, I want to thank you so much for taking time to come on the show and share your work with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for being so generous to invite me for this. I mean, it truly is an honor and flattering, and I'm still a bit nervous.